Hi everyone, and welcome to this special episode of Low Season Traveller Insider Guides. I'm your host, Jed Brown, founder of Low Season Traveller, and some of you may know that we work very closely with both the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage and also My Travel Research. As part of this relationship, we've been organising a series of tourism recovery webinars where we're speaking to global industry leaders from the tourism industry and seeking to learn how we can come out of this current situation with more resilience. Our fourth keynote of the series was with Carolyn Childs from My Travel Research, who is the world's leading expert in tourism marketing and research analysis. As with previous episodes in this special series, this is the Q&A session which followed the keynote. I hope you find this interesting, and we'll bring you the Q&A from every session as we move forward. Enjoy.
Carolyn, thank you so much for that wonderful presentation. There was just a huge amount of information in there. It felt like it was an MBA, in marketing, in an hour. Absolutely incredible, and thank you so much for that. We've actually had quite a lot of questions, but there's one that I'd just like to go to straight away, which is a question from Sean, which I thought was a really, really interesting one. And his question is this: companies that need to come out better off need to take the hard decisions. Many companies are laying off staff right now. But study also shows from your presentation that for the brands to come out better off, they need to increase their marketing spend. Carolyn, what is your perspective when a brand lays off staff and then spends more money on marketing? Does this impact the brand negatively in any way? Does it affect the goodwill factor?
Yes, it does. And it's an enormously hard balancing act. And I never want to underestimate how hard some of the decisions are about doing this. So I think there's a couple of things. It's about communication. So when you're laying off staff and you're explaining to them that you have to do this, you have to be framing it around why you're doing that. And you have to be honest and transparent about that. And you also have, just as not even more importantly, to be actually communicating with people who are your existing staff. Because one of the things we know is that there's huge survivor guilt from the staff who survived downturns. So you have to be explaining to them that this is about securing as many of those jobs as you can, and about why that is the reason you've had to spend your money that way right now. In those countries where you've got job seeker allowances, as we have in Australia, as I know, Jed, you have in the UK, that's where you're using those tools and you're saying we're keeping as many people as we can, but if we don't have customers coming in, you have to be really honest. And you, I think it's okay to show your pain and show how hard this is for you. But I'm never going to underestimate that. And I think the other thing is you have to have a bloody great PR strategy for when that comes out. So some disgruntled staff member is laid off, understandably heartbroken, looking at paying their mortgage. They're going to go and say, well, why are you launching this ad campaign? And you need to be very, very clear about this as a job saving device.
It kind of links with I think it was either John Kuldowski or it might have been Dr. David Bierman, where he was saying about the sensitivity of handling those layoffs is just so critical. And I don't know what yourself have sort of heard, Carolyn, over recent weeks, or what any of our listeners and audience have heard, but I've heard certainly quite a few experiences where it just hasn't been handled very well by the organization. You know, they've done it at practically a whim. They've done it relatively insensitively. And it's, you know, I think that's probably going to be an effect, or have an effect on those brands and organizations as well, right?
Absolutely. If you think about how you let staff go as being part of your marketing, and what that message and what the optics of that are, it will help you. I have a theory that one of the reasons people are so bad at laying off staff is because we feel so bad, and we get rid of the bad feeling in us. We're not thinking about that empathy for the person on the other side. Well, we are, but we don't express it that way. And often this is also where that balance of what you can say legally versus what you can't say comes in. So this is where I think you really need to plan it well. And I would be honest and say we have someone, another speaker coming up in the series from Tourism Talent, who is going to probably address this better than I could in terms of the how to do that. But if you remember that big part of how your brand is going to be is how you manage the shit stuff, if you'll forgive my language, that's why managers get paid the big bucks. We don't get paid the big bucks for when times are good. We get paid it for when you have to look at someone in the face who you respect, who is a talented staff member, and let them go.
Yeah. Great. Very great. Great question there, Sean. Thank you. Thank you for that. Other questions that we've got coming in. If you have worked 100,
I've got a question.
Oh, sorry. Go on, Chris. Yeah.
I'm quite interested. I was interested in the sentiment trending upwards and turning that curve fairly quickly. How can you turn that into action in a depressed environment? What would be your advice for that?
Well, I think the first thing, Chris, is to be aware that it's there. And to be keeping an eye out. And there's lots of stuff in the press at the moment talking about this. So there's absolutely heaps of information out there. If you've got a marketing department, get them to be watching that. I think, again, it's really about balancing that and looking at it and saying, you know, the early stages of that were really that thing that you saw with TA, Tourism Australia, where they were, you know, feeding that with content, with messages, with kind of emotive stuff, but always doing it through the framework of their own work. So I think David showed their campaign in his session in the first of the series. So they were using their locations, but they were using an energy about this. They were using an Australian philosophy to draw on, which is, you know, I always say Australia is a country for people who like dealing with crises, because, you know, we do have bushfires, we have immense variations in our weather cycle. We also incidentally have immense variations in our exchange rate. It's a hideous place to run a business in some ways from that point of view. So I think we, you know, that idea of the resilience of the Australian character was something that they really tapped into for that. And that idea of we're coming back, we're going to be back, but here's something to be looking at. So, you know, we've seen a lot of pictures of a lot of stories around the animals around there. So the one that really went, it's a specifically Australian example, but what I would always encourage people to say is what's your equivalent of the koalas at Port Macquarie Hospital? So some of the koalas that were put at, were made homeless or were injured during the Australian bushfires earlier this year, Port Macquarie Koala Hospital. If you ever come to Australia, go to Port Macquarie Koala Hospital. It's awesome. They shot some video of the volunteers releasing the recovered koalas back into the wild. Now, we know our koalas are an absolute fast track to every human being's amygdala. They deal with our reptile brain of emotion. We want to bond, we want to connect. But it's told a story of hope and resilience in a uniquely Australian way. So, you know, I could see we had some people, you know, what would a story of resilience and a unique story of hope in a uniquely Malaysian way or a uniquely adventure tourism way be? You know, is it walking up mountains? So I think it's how can you do that and how can you leverage that in those different stages of the plan? And that's why the plan is so important, Chris. And the, okay, when the consumer mindset gets to here, this is what messages we're going to, how will we know we've got there? That's what TA know. What messages do we need to put out there and what channels do we need to put them in? And that's how you operationalize that, is you have a plan. And if you see a second outbreak come out, which I think we will see second outbreaks, how are you pivoting to deal with that? How are you pivoting if the consumer mindset goes up and then suddenly they see another outbreak and it kind of pivots back down? What's your plan? So plans in that kind of detail with backup plans are your friend in the new abnormal.
Another question, great question here from Berendian Lube. Forgive me if I've pronounced your name incorrectly, Berendian. What about if you were just about to launch a new product and were interrupted through lockdown? What would the best marketing strategy be, given it is an unknown product, new company, unknown brand? Product may be regarded as green.
By green, we mean environmental, I'm guessing.
I'm guessing so, yeah.
I'm going to be a bit cautious about answering that question, Jed, because I don't know enough about the product to know how it connects to the mindset. But I think the principles I've talked about here is, I'd get everyone on a Zoom or a GoToWebinar call in your marketing team, get that evidence together and understand, are we ready yet? And if we, you know, is the consumer mindset ready? Is it gonna clang? When is that point? And again, it's probably gonna sound a little bit repetitive, but I would be filling those buckets of information, because what I tried to do today was not say, go away and do this. What I tried to say is, these are the buckets that you need to fill in your marketing. The bucket of where's the consumer mindset? Well, the bucket of who's the consumer and what motivates them, the bucket of where the mindset is, and the bucket of, you know, who are we and what are we? Now, I would probably say for a green product, if you are able to pivot very quickly, one point to launch that might have been when we started to see the bottom of the canals in Venice, or, we saw communities that saw the Himalayas for the first time. So if your product was something that was engaging you to take something to that place, for example, I would be having those moments. This is what I mean by being truly agile, that if you saw something that brought that out, that you saw something that was coming out, that you could tie it to, you know, when you come back, we'll be ready to take you to see the Himalayas, and we'll be the company to do that because of this. If one of those occasions doesn't occur for your product, I honestly think it's a matter of short-term timing for anything that's an environmentally sustainable product, because all of the issues that existed before we had COVID-19 are going to be there. We have 10 years to save the planet. And that is not, that's going to be helped a little bit by COVID-19. Ironically, Mother Nature has said, look, go back to the drawing board a bit, guys. But that reality, that existential threat that is one of those ticking minutes on the doomsday clock, is not there. So that moment when people are back out and starting to pivot to the next normal, to me, would be trying to find, if you haven't found that opportunistic tactical moment before, that that would be the moment to do it.
Fantastic. Thank you for the question, Berendia.
Actually, just before you move on, I'd just like to welcome Berendian. She's one of our new members from Pretoria University. So shout out to you, Brendan, and it's great to have you with us as part of our family. So thank you.
Fantastic. Another question linked to that one. This is from Lynn Hocking. If you've worked 100% in the past with international clients, and now you need to reprice and maybe redesign products for domestic, what are the challenges that go along with that? And also, it was kind of in follow-up, how about deposit-free bookings, which I guess links to the example you gave there for P&O, which I suppose is altogether it's linked with the issue of trust, isn't it? Is that one of the biggest wider issues that we've got as a result of this within the industry, that there's been some kind of an erosion of trust that we've had?
I think there's an erosion of trust. I wouldn't actually say a deposit free. What I like about the $1 is that there is something committed to that. So what I think you want to do in this situation is you get the customer to commit to you, but what you say in return is you leave them that freedom to walk away, that flexibility. So I think I wouldn't be in favor of no deposit. I would be in favor of a small incremental deposit, an amount of money that maybe you can put to something. So P&O, use a dollar, because who is really, among people who are likely to cruise after this, who is not got a dollar? And you've captured their details, you've got that commitment. The reason P&O is able to do that is because they know that the vast majority of people who do that are going to go on and book and put down money later on. So I think if you've got that little bit firmer commitment, the level of loss aversion, that 3-time ratio, is going to be greater. If you are doing domestic, I think, as I said, what I would be looking at is looking at that idea of how can you create that excitement from reconnection. and how can you, so understand the domestic consumer, because it is a little bit different. I know Lynn personally, so I know that she's based in Australia. I'm going to use Australia as an example. We know that Australians, as I mentioned on when we were talking to John and David earlier, they're the most demanding consumers on the planet, and they're some of I wouldn't say they're tight with their money, but they expect a lot for their money. So I would say that that's something that you can do. The other thought I had, and this comes back to the very first Domesticate study, which was a study of the domestic tourism mindset in Australia that I worked on in 2006. Does anyone remember having a granny who had one of those piggy banks that said money for rent, money for electricity, money for gas? I can hear you laughing, Jed, so I know you do. And people said, we'd like one of those. So could you create some money boxes for your clients? Could you create a virtual money box on your digital site, which is a savings bank? All of the banks do this. In Australia, the Commonwealth Bank has this thing where, they sign kids up and you get a piggy bank. Given that we don't change banks very easily, I can't tell you how much money that has generated for Commonwealth Bank, because you're creating that thing that you've got that commitment, but you've also helping them, that be helpful moment. So I'd be saying, what if you were to say to people, why don't you have a savings? Why couldn't you open a savings account for them? A joint savings account.
Yeah.
Could you do something like that? Could you create that virtual slot money box where they're putting money in? The only way I would say, I wouldn't say do it as no charge deposit. The other way I would do it as a redundancy deposit. And the cruise industry did this during the last crisis in the USA. So they said to people, if you have a job now and you can prove to us you have a job, and you put down a deposit or you pay for your holiday, if you lose your job, and again, you need to provide us evidence, it will be 100% money back, no questions asked.
I love that.
I love it too. It's super smart. Yeah.
It's interesting. During the hard times that we've had, I'm sure everybody in our audience has had hard times, from a personal point of view, as well as from a business point of view. But during the personal times when we've had hardship in the past, when, myself or my wife might have been out of work, we've actually had, like you say, we've had little envelopes. And there's little envelopes where we actually fill the cash in. So we get the cash at the beginning of the month, and we used to put, this is the cash for the electricity bill, this is the food shopping, this is for petrol. And it just helps you to kind of understand a little bit more visually your budget. And I think something like that, to be able to do that for clients, like you say, to have a virtual piggy bank, I think that's just a wonderful idea. I could see that really taking off.
That's focus groups for you. They still have a role, Jed. But it's also, it does two things. One, it helps you do that budget, but two, it gives you hope. Because I bet you I know which of those envelopes you most enjoy putting money in.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a bad time, but my dream trip is still to go to Antarctica. And anyone who's looked at going to Antarctica knows this is it's a trip of a lifetime, and it's an investment of a lifetime. We actually have a savings account that it's called the Antarctica Fund. So I think that that's where, and that, but that, what I really liked about the cruise example that I gave you is anyone who was questioning that was going to put it down. Now, in actual fact, 95% of the people who put down a deposit under that deal would not have lost their jobs. 5% might, and what we know informally, qualitatively, I've heard from some of the cruise companies is, 40% of those people actually spent some of their redundancy money taking the cruise anyway, because you needed a holiday if you just lost your job. But the point is, you had 95% of those bookings. If you hadn't taken those bookings, they would have sat there and gone into distressed inventory. It's a heck of a lot harder and a heck of a lot less profitable to shift distressed inventory. Often people talk a lot about I'm giving something away. You're not giving something away if the customer's not going to give you their money for it anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's right.
I want to get through. We've got loads of questions, so I've got to crack on, Carolyn. Question here from Tony Hallwood. Good morning to you, Tony. Carolyn, do you believe that the ineffective manner in which the British government has dealt with the COVID-19 impact has tarnished the image and reputation on the UK travel industry? I see the Sydney Daily Herald today is highlighting the way in which the UK responded to the virus. Has this delivered long-term damage to the UK inbound tourism market?
Okay, as an England cricket supporter who lives in Australia, Tony, the first thing I'd have to say is that you have to realise that a certain amount of that news is going to happen. This is an important question. This is probably going to show my biases here, and apologise to any passionate Brexiteers. The UK has already done quite a lot of damage over the last few years to its brand on those things. And I do have a shout out for the guys at places like Visit Britain who have really done a great job at trying to minimise that and really to keep the focus on the things that people love about Britain and why. And I think they've managed to manage some of that, because again, I think it's worth remembering, I am a news junkie, so I look at those things. The majority of people, it kind of may have chipped away at it, but I don't think it's going to change it compared to the compelling content. I think there will be some short-term damage, but it's going to depend on what happens next. And that's where I think it will change. At the moment, people might be thinking, well, am I going to be coming? Because there's a safety concern about whether the UK government has prepared for that. But if the UK government handles the next stage well, then I think they will be forgotten. Because one of the things is, it's now, without getting into whether people are right or wrong, it's much easier. Hindsight tends to confer 100% vision on what we should have done. Some of those decisions, I mean, I'll be honest and come out and say, I completely called it wrong. I was very critical of the Australian government when they closed the border with China. I thought that was very damaging. I was totally wrong. They had to take a decision and they took it. I mean, maybe the UK didn't take decisions that they should have done. But I think you have to offset that against the clap for the NHS, which is an awesome piece of global branding, which originated, I think, in the UK. I think Italy and Spain and some of those guys have taken it on as well. But you stand out and see that, and it's on the news every week. And it speaks to things about Britain that are probably more important than the government, which is that the people are important on any destination. And it speaks to a sense of British resilience that I think is quite powerful. It also, for all the criticism of things, when you look at that, having those hero healthcare workers in the NHS, when people in the US are looking at, it's going to cost them $5,000 to get tested, that's a big inbound market. I think, so short answer, Tony, I'm aware I'm rambling a bit because I'm really thinking this through. I think there's a risk of short-term damage. It's going to depend on what happens next. But I think there are counter messages and messages that are more connected with what we're doing that should stand up against that in the longer run.
Right. Chris, any questions from your side?
I've got a good question. Yeah. Got a question from Stu here, which I think is interesting. Do you think the underlying motivations for travel will change as a result of COVID-19?
Yes and no. As I said, there's theories about the idea that we're always in different motivational states, but I always think I have a home state. And I'm going to go back to that cruise with my mum. I loved every single moment of the moment I spent with my mum and my sister, but I kind of felt like there was nothing left for me in that holiday. And I actually had to say to them, look, can we just do this one thing that's my thing? Just so that I feel like, it is my holiday too. I know it's got to be mum's holiday number one. I think our motivations to travel, I think connection will redial up, which is also good because domestic is where we're going to go first and reconnection sits to that. So I think that will dial up. I think safety will affect more people as a part of how they choose their destinations and their experiences. Feeling safe will be more important rather than just to that very cautious group. I think some of those cautiously extravagant group will look at safety. And as we saw, they're going to change the way they travel. Because they've thought this through. So I think those reassurance measures down at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs around the physiological needs and the safety and security are going to need to be a bigger part of what we do. But I think that they're going to have to be, there's still going to be permission unless you're a totally cautious traveler. You know, I've looked at all of these things where we've seen people kind of on plexiglass on beaches and stuff like that. And I'm kind of like, well, that's not going to, you know, I'm not so keen on safety, but I'm going to lie on a beach with plexiglass around me. I'd rather go out for a walk at home. So I think we need to be making sure that we tick enough of those boxes. I'd say that's almost in a kind of reassurance piece alongside, but I would get people excited first, then have that helpful piece to say, here's how we're looking after your health. Have it fairly early in the process, but at the end of the day, you know, I'm not looking at that from a point of view of I'm not going somewhere that has, I'm looking at the Adelaide Hills because I was looking at the Adelaide Hills before COVID-19 hit. And I know that my dollars are going to do good there. In my case, because I sit more on that kind of right side of the map, I'm thinking about more of my bucket list things coming through. So I don't think we can only assume it's about safety and security. Maybe we felt life's a little bit more tenuous and precious, so maybe we'll see more people taking those dream trips. My backing, if I use Zoom, is Mungo National Park, and Jed and Chris and I have talked about this, which is somewhere I've been talking about going to Mungo for 10 years. I'm already waiting to try and see when I can go, because it's somewhere I've dreamed about going for a long time. It's safe because it's in the, you know, the Australian bubble, and it's fairly remote. I'll have to make sure I look after myself because it's a big Indigenous community and Indigenous communities are vulnerable. So I'm probably thinking more about those things, but it's dialed that up for me. So I don't think we can assume it's going to be all about safety and security. Really, none of us know. And, you know, it's a terrible tendency to fall into the guru trap here and try and say we know the answer to that. I think it will change it, but I don't think we can entirely predict all the ways that it will change. We just need to keep listening and paying attention. The real gurus here are the customers.
It's interesting though the way in which the, you know, you almost feel that the consumer mindset is actually changing as we progress through the lockdown as well. You know, at first a lot of people were talking about, you know, people aren't going to want to travel, and now there's starting to be a feeling, and we've seen it on the Forward Keys data, and I've seen Kiwi data, which is similar, that actually there seems to be that feeling of, you know, actually what once the world opens up, I'm going to travel like never before, because God forbid, you know, the next pandemic will be significantly worse. So therefore, I'm going to need to grab my opportunity while I can. So maybe we could see actually an even greater increased desire and demand for travel at the end of this, eh?
And it's interesting you say that, Jed, because we talked about, you remember that cycle of trends? I'm going to honestly say those cycles are shortening. Those cycles used to take 100, 200 years. Now they take 2 to 3. But we also see counter trends. And one of the things I always say to people is there's enormous opportunity. It's my third law of trends, is there are enormous opportunities in counter trends. If everyone else is charging that way and you're charging that way, there's probably money to be made because no one else is doing it. And I think at every stage of history, so we saw after World War One, we saw a desire for stability, but we also saw the explosion of hedonism. You know, people felt that life was so temporary that they had to live for the moment. The other thing I think that was a trend we saw long before COVID-19 was the changing of the meaning of travel in our lives. You know, 50 years ago, unless you were very wealthy, travel was a luxury. With each successive crisis, it's dipped because it's a higher good, it tends to get cut. But the point at which people cut it out of their lives, other than when they physically can't travel, like a pandemic, gets later and later and later. We saw that during the global financial crisis, that people were, you know, they fought to hang on to their holidays and they sacrificed other things to keep them. We've moved from travel being a privilege to travel and being a right. Now that creates all sorts of problems like over tourism in normal times. But I think we need to be aware that the meaning of travel is going to change. And that's why we see that bounce back, come back, like, as you say, in the Forward Keys data and the Travelsat data and the Kiwi data, is because we haven't lost our love for travel. It hasn't, the meaning it has in our life, the extent to which we draw who we are from the travel we take, I think particularly the more experiential end of travel. I think the all of those things have meant that if we take away travel, we're taking away part of who we are. I mean, certainly for me, my travel is a big part of who I am. And if you take that from me, that there was actually a stage of almost bereavement. So you think of that classic cycle, we've moved through that. So I think we have to be aware of that changed meaning of travel and what we think about.
Maybe the 2020s are almost going to be like the new 60s, you know, yes. when we sort of came out of the war and everything was all about, you know, love and make the most of everything. And, you know, maybe that will be the 2020s. Maybe that's how we'll come out of this. Chris, any more questions from your side?
No, I'm just about done, to be honest with you, Jed. Have you got any?
Yeah, I've got a couple more, but I am very conscious of time as well. There's one from Mark Charette. Very good afternoon, evening to you, Mark.
Hello, Mark.
What are you finding is the biggest barrier to motivation for marketers inside businesses from changing and updating their strategy? Is it just old habits die hard, or is there something else we can tap into?
I think old habits die hard. And particularly at periods of stress, we do want to revert into new things, Mark, which is it's a great question. Thank you. Which is why I've been fighting against that new normal, because that new normal, by definition, I think new normal is secretly hoping that we'll be able to bring some of the old normal with us. As I say, while we can't throw everything out, say nothing that we learnt in the past, I think we do need to be promoting that, you know. Human beings don't really like change. We like habit, we like normality. So I think we are fighting, and again, that varies for different people. Some people love change, some people thrive on it. But on balance, on average, I think that the reason that marketers are like that is because marketers are like everyone else. And it's scary because the things that we used to know would work now no longer work. But what I'd actually say is, in some ways, this is the best of times to be trying that crazy stuff, because who's going to know if it went wrong? If it went wrong, who's going to know if it went wrong because it was a stupid idea, or if it went wrong just because the circumstances were wrong? Yeah. But if it goes well, oh my God, what a result you've got. So that's one of the other things I've been saying, in that kind of, you know, 60% of your built marketing that's that long-term building, do the crazy stuff, do the campaign that you could never get over the line normally, or the crazy marketing channel that you've always wanted to try, but you could never get it over because it wasn't as proven as the traditional ones, because we don't precisely know what's going to work in this new framework. So much has changed, other than holding in your place, well, what is the person there to do? And the reason I use that example, Mark will know, the guys at this link, because I know he's just up the road from them. You know, the reason I really like that was that recognition that, you know, if you're going out into social media going bye, 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 you have to remember, as the guy said, you know, 20% of your audience is reading you while they're sat on the toilet. And they're just not that into you. They're looking for entertainment while their mind, while, you know, other parts of their body are doing something. Or they're looking to catch up with how their family in the UK, you know, if I'm in social media, I'm looking for my family in the UK. Unless you're connecting with something that's in that mindset of entertaining me or giving me something, why would you think that's how you would start by selling to me? And I know Mark's work, Mark is a Google certified photographer. He helps people bring their experiences alive for people. So I think I actually think you're going to go well in this, Mark, because we're not going to be able to travel. So that virtual tour is going to work really well. But I think it is that fear of the unknown and the, well, I know this will work. Remember that quote I said about, you know, people don't choose this because it's better. They choose it because they're more confident that it's good. That's why I think people are not changing, because we by nature favor what we know to be working over that. That loss aversion comes through. I mean, people won't even give away things that are costing them money when they could be offered something that costs them, that gives them more money, because we love what we have so much. So we need to be thinking about behavior change models to do that. And we need to be applying that to our discipline as marketers.
That's great. Great point, Mark. Last question, I think.
I had a question here from Daniel. Partnerships. Is it a good time to combine strengths and assets to transition out of COVID-19 by forging partnerships and building strength?
Daniel, I think you know the answer to that yourself. All you're looking for me is to confirm it is at any time in tourism, the right partnerships are a great thing to do. 95% of tourism businesses around the world on average are, you know, in different countries, are small to medium enterprises. You almost certainly haven't got enough money to do what you want. And often the biggest problem, one of the things I like to say, I work a lot with regional destinations around the world. One of the things I like to say is your biggest problem is not whether they're staying in your hotel or the hotel next door. The biggest problem is not enough people are driving down that road. And partnerships are there. And we actually, years ago, some of the inland New South Wales research that I shared earlier, we actually asked people what made them choose to go to certain regional areas. You know, and in Australia, a context of this is, visiting a regional area is somewhere between 2 and 14 hours of driving, or, you know, several hours of flying. No one's going to do that for one experience unless it's Mona, the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart, is the exception that proves the rule. So finding the right partners to do stuff is to create that complexity. We know that clusters work. There's a reason why medieval streets, why London has a milk street where you bought your milk. There's a reason why London has a pudding lane, because that's where you went to buy your baking. It's because you knew you were going to get what you wanted, that certainty again. So the more that you can say to people by coming together and creating a cluster of experiences, could be a cluster of themed experiences. The Prosecco Road in Victoria's King Valley here in Australia, great example, Italian varietal wines. Focus on Prosecco, which was quite new in Australia at the time, creates a reason to go there. There's a blog piece on the mytravelresearch.com website, if you search for it, that talks about that. So I'm absolutely a believer in partnerships at any time, but in this time of needing to band together and looking for feeling part of that collective, that stabilized framework, I think partnerships are more important than ever.
I suppose, and to, you know, just to add to that, Carolyn, you know, that's what we are. You know, there's the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage, My Travel Research, okay, Low Season Traveller. That's exactly what we've done, Daniel. You know, we've sort of, you know, come together in a spirit of collaboration. I think collaboration is absolutely essential for all of us to move forward. Yeah. Last question, Carolyn, if you don't mind, and I am conscious of time, we've got so many in the audience still here. Thank you so much to everybody for sticking with us. We really appreciate it. This question, it's still early for me, guys. This question is from Dimitris in Greece. Countries need to come up with innovative ways to directly target and attract potential travellers. What could these be, given that conventional tourism expos and fairs are out of the question and collaborative promotions with OTAs, etc., proven to be too costly? And the reason I wanted to ask that question last is there's a little bit of a hint of a link to our next speaker on Tuesday, of course, Stu Spears, who's going to be talking more about events and expos. But what do you think, Carolyn? Is there any other innovative ways that we can come up with in the absence of the conventional tourism and expo fairs?
Well, the first thing I would say is if you found partnerships with OTAs were effective but too expensive for the ROI, I'd go back and negotiate right now, because I think that will be something that would be different. But definitely, and again, you know, maybe I think maybe I need to, Stu, can I unmute you so you might, we can join this discussion? I know you're self-muted, so if you wanted to unmute and join the discussion, Stu, last thing I want, I'm happy to stand on the shoulders of Stu as a particular giant, but I'm very aware that he has more expertise. Look, right now we're seeing people are getting used to the idea of virtual events. We're seeing our social space, so I think that would be one way. And I think the other thing is, tools like virtual reality and augmented reality, I think, are great ways to be getting that out there. I don't know how many people follow David Matten of Trend Watching with his New World Same Humans, which I love as a name for a kind of a narrative around this topic, because, like I said, 50,000 years of the same frameworks, that way we make decisions. But he was talking about this. I mean, 10 years ago when Second Life came out, I thought this is how all tourist boards are going to promote in the future. But there's a new game called New Horizons, virtual reality game that you can play online. And apparently people are visiting tourism destinations in there. So I'd be saying, I'd be going to talk to the games developers of that and trying to get your destinations in there and, you know, giving people that virtual experience. And I'd also be exploring, in the context of over tourism, flight shaming, and the world that we're going to deal with once we've dealt with COVID-19 and the economic mix, I'd also be thinking, can we start monetizing that? You know, people pay to go to a travel expo. I mean, some of them are free. I know we have a big travel expo here in Sydney where I'm based, where it's free. But I've been to, you know, I pay to go to wine shows, for example. Or you pay to go in, or you pay on the door. So people will pay to go to some of these things. So can we start to monetize the virtual reality experience rather than just give it away for free, which we're all too want to do in tourism? So I think virtual events are ways to do it. I think, I mean, it's interesting, there's been a lot of debate about whether we're now past the phase of using influencers. I think the big problem with that was we didn't know who influencers really were, because at the end of the day, influencers are just people who influence, and word of mouth is still part of that. So I think what we're now doing is we're moving beyond the phase where everyone gets terribly excited about influencers, waste a lot of money on influencers who don't help them do this, and start to sit down and think about doing that. So, you know, if you're targeting family holidays, for example, Facebook mums groups, oh my God. This is an amazing way to generate conversation. Jed, I'm thinking you know your mum.
Yeah. Well, over mum's debt, my wife is, and it's absolutely insanely good, she says.
Yes. And the level of engagement that you will get with that. And, you know, the interesting thing about those groups is, you know, some of those people will want paying, particularly the savvy marketing mums in there. But if you look at who are those networks of, who's got good networks with the messages you want to do, not all of them want to be paid. Quite a lot of people, you know, everything we share on social media about destinations, we do because the currency we're paying in is, this makes me look cool. So I'd be saying, look, maybe we don't need to do the big stuff. Maybe it is really at that level of doing something different. The other thing I'd probably say is, I've talked more at the kind of small scale digital marketing, ignoring those big studies at the beginning were all done about advertising. David Bierman in his session talked about how Visit Britain has got ads up, all, and this will link to, I guess, to Tony Hallward's question as well, has got ads up for London all over the railway stations in Sydney. Now, it's not that a huge heap of people are traveling, but no one else is out there traveling, talking destination. So here's the thing, if you're that person on the train and suddenly there's no one else around you, you've got space to look around you and you're going through station after station where you're seeing that kind of plucky British spirit, you know, we're still out there, you're going to go home and talk about that. So I think that's where doing that, and, you know, again, that counter trend, if everyone else is pulling back from advertising, every dollar you spend has a much, much bigger effect. The marketing gurus talk about, they call it ESOV, excess share of voice, which is every dollar that you spend at this time above your share in the market, every single share of voice that you dollar you spend that contributes to your share of voice really delivers you a return, but it disappears very quickly when other people start to come back into advertising. So now is really that time to be getting out and targeting people and thinking about, you know, my guess is right now there's an awful lot of media out there who will be prepared to talk to you about rates that they would have told you to go get stuffed a year ago.
Fair play. You know, I noticed that we've got Stu has joined. Stu, did you have any thoughts on this?
Here we go.
Stu, welcome.
Thank you very much. Look, really, really briefly, in terms of expos, I tend to agree with Carolyn that it feels like virtual events feel like the way that things will move, whether that could be a mix between more curated expos, so it's not a cram fest as such. But when it comes to public-facing events, there's some really interesting models, which we'll touch on Tuesday night, day in other parts of the world. which are particularly in relation to cultural events. There are certain events out there, even before COVID hit, that were talking about self-guided cultural events and self-guided art events within that were very much rooted in the place that event is was actually taking place in. So when it comes to B2C events, there's some really interesting models which we'll touch on Tuesday.
Awesome. Really looking forward to the session on Tuesday as well, Stu. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Stu. And sorry, it was telling me initially you were self-muted, so I wasn't unclicking you, but I'm delighted you can join the conversation. So.
Very good. Carolyn, I think that is all we've got time for. Thank you so much for the wonderful presentation and the in-depth Q&A. Thank you to everybody for all of the questions which we had. We've still got questions coming in, and unfortunately we can't get through all of them, but we really do appreciate it. I think we've got through most of them.
So there we have it. Our huge thanks again go to Carolyn Childs from My Travel Research for providing us with her insights this week. And the full episode can be viewed online at wtach.org. And you can register for the future episodes, which will be running throughout May on Tuesdays and Thursdays. The fifth special episode in this series is with Stu Spears, who is one of the tourism industry's leading experts in the field of sustainable events, and he'll be taking us through the six fundamentals for sustainable events. Until then, have a great week, stay healthy, stay safe, stay home, and don't forget to share this podcast with your friends, family, and social networks. Our content will always be free for everyone, as we believe that travel is better without the crowds.